You're listening to Autumn on the Air, the weekly podcast that brings you conversations about the impact of research commercialization and the people who make it happen. Join us for interviews with patent and licensing professionals, innovators, entrepreneurs, and tech transfer leaders on the issues and trends that matter most. Keep listening for an inside track on the people, IP policies, and politics changing our world.
Academia plays a crucial role in societal progress, with significant public funds invested in higher education and research institutions. However, this support is undermined by pervasive sexism within academia, leading to the loss of talented women and hindering scientific advancement. Today, we're diving into a critical issue plaguing academia: sexism and its detrimental effect on science and public funding. Our discussion is inspired by the paper, Sexism in Academia is Bad for Science and a Waste of Public Funding, authored by Nicole Bovian, Susan Tauber, Yuriki Besiegel, Ursula Keller, and Janet Herring. Today, I'm joined by Janet, Yuriki, and Ursula to discuss the systemic barriers faced by women in academia. With a distinguished career spanning from Caltech to UCLA before moving to Switzerland in 2007, Janet is Director Emerita of the Swiss Federal Institute of Aquatic Science and Technology and Professor Emerita at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology in Zurich and Lausanne. She's a former Associate Editor of Environmental Science and Technology and a member of the U.S. National Academy of Engineering and Academia Europea. Janet played a pivotal role in advancing gender equality as a founding vice chair of the ETH Women Professors Forum and received a Distinguished Women in Chemistry or Chemical Engineering Award from the IUPAC in 2015. Yuriki Besiegel's extensive scientific career includes roles such as a professor of biochemistry and director of the Institute of Biochemistry and Molecular Biology at the University Hospital in Hamburg, as well as the president of the University of Göttingen. She has held numerous official positions in the German academic system, including membership in the German Science Council and the Max Planck Society. Yuriki has received honorary doctorates from institutions such as the Medical Faculty of Umea and the University of Edinburgh. Ursula Keller, a tenured physics professor at ETH Zurich since 1993, is renowned for her work in ultrafast science and technology. Ursula has received numerous awards, including the Swiss Science Prize Marcel Benoist, OSA Frederick Ives Medal, and SPIE Gold Medal. Ursula has also co-founded successful companies such as Time Bandwidth Products and K2 Photonics. She's currently serving on the supervisory board of Genopetic and has authored a new graduate textbook on ultrafast laser published by Springer. Welcome, Janet, Ursula, and Eureka. So glad to have you here on the podcast.
Yeah, it's great. Good to be here. Hello.
Well, I'm really excited to have the three of you on the podcast today. So we have a lot to talk about. So let's go ahead and dig in. Now, it's well known that across many academic disciplines, women and men are increasingly graduating at similar rates. However, despite these improvements, the academic stages beyond the graduate level remain persistently gender imbalanced across all disciplines, and this doesn't seem to be changing. Based on your experiences and research, what has caused this imbalance, and what do you think can be done to help correct it?
Yes, I can. I think one important point is that there is a well-known imbalance in terms of family care. This is inhibiting female careers. So that's one fact which I just say once, and I think we have to keep it in mind. But in addition, there is a traditional culture in the academia dominated by male rules and male networks. And there is a deep-going unconscious bias in the academic system for everybody, not only for men. And if you ask what can be done to correct, it's not so simple, but women need to become more resilient and courageous, and men need to be more open and accept the different perspectives and the behavior of women. And if that can be reached, I think from the people in the system, that might help.
Yeah, so it sounds like a lot of unconscious bias training is still needed, especially for men. Janet, do you have some thoughts on this as well?
Yes, I agree with everything Ulrike has said, but I'd also like to point out that the academic system itself has a large number of incentives built in that really encourage people to act in a very competitive, sometimes even hostile way. And if those incentives are not changed, you can't expect people to change their behavior.
Can you give us some examples of some of those incentives?
Well, I mean, one thing, of course, is that awards are given often to individuals or very small groups. The Nobel is the classic example with a maximum of three people. But we all know that science today is done in large teams, and we need to be able to recognize those team efforts.
Absolutely. Now, I want to talk about advancement and advanced career stages for women in academia. And generally, as women progress to more advanced academic career stages, they expect that they are going to have greater stability. But your research showed that, in fact, this wasn't the case. Can you share with us what you found?
I mean, maybe I can jump in because, you know, I did my career in physics, which is definitely a male-dominated field. And I honestly, at the beginning, thought all I need to do is show performance and then they will accept me. And as I had to learn over time, the more successful I became, the less I was actually accepted. And it had to do with this bias that a woman has to perform within a certain kind of box. And if you, as a woman, show the same ambition like a man, you know, the same request for resources and privileges, then suddenly you go over this box and you are perceived as a perturbation or not liked and so on. And that is really a substantial problem. And I have some very specific solution suggestions to that, but that is the perception because many of the male colleagues, they normally interact with women in a serving role, you know, people who serve them, not who compete against them. And when a woman then ultimately wins and tells them no, it gets some pretty strong emotional reaction with some of them.
So they're fine competing with their male counterparts, but competing with females, they have issues with. Ulrike, you have some comments, I think, as well.
Yes, I can truly support that. And my personal observations are that young women are supported and well tolerated and they are used in academia. But coming in senior position, just like Ursi just explained, they become highly qualified competitors and thereby they are a threat for male scientists. And I think one of the reasons is that they do not know the unofficial rules in the male network and they easily become killjoys. So they're not playing in the same game. And even if they know the rules, they might not be ready, just like Ursula just explained, to adapt to them, but bring in their own perspective and their own expertise. And this is difficult then to expect for the dominant male network, and those strong women are mobbed out of their position in a way. And only if female scientists just adapt to the system and stay quiet, then they are well tolerated. And it's just like my observation supporting what Ozil's experience is.
Now, why do you think it is that some behavior is viewed more positively for male academic leaders, such as assertiveness, but viewed negatively for female academic leaders?
Well, I could come in there and really highlight that it's not just women in academics. Women in every single sector report the same issues. Sometimes it's more or less visible, but some of the really harshest kind of backlash has been exercised against women in politics. And because they're public facing and they are present on the internet and other places where people honestly go a little bit insane in responding.
And not only politics, also in companies.
And then maybe one more thing, because if the governance is bad in an organization, you know, the whole power structure is basically ruled by informal networks. And there, our male colleagues are very well organized. They feel really comfortable about this one. And the women tend to be not in it. Normally, they accept one or two but the women have to behave in a certain way. And if they want to have actually the equal access to the power, resources, and privileges, then they're not welcome in this network anymore. So they, what you always see is that you have this informal network with a few younger women saying that there is, everything is okay. These younger women are even being used to tell that the problem is really with this senior woman who is not a team player and a troublemaker. And these women don't realize what they're actually doing because they also have their own biases to senior women, I may say. And, you know, if they're not playing along anymore, they're out of it. And then it's too late.
Ulrika?
Yes, and we have to realize that power is masculine annotated or masculine annotated. And if women are assertive, they are criticized for being dictatorial. And women are expected to be motherly, but if they behave as such, they are criticized for being too weak. So female leadership is in many aspects misinterpreted, and the benchmarks for leadership quality are totally different for men and women. They are just measured with different standards. And that is also one of the facts that it can't work in a way.
Yeah. And I was thinking back, Janet, to your comment about politics. And one individual that comes to mind, who I think is a really good example, that was Jacinda Ardern from New Zealand, who was the prime minister there, who really was harshly treated in the media, and especially when she decided to resign for mental health reasons and decided to put her own mental health ahead of her. She was considered weak and highly criticized. I think that's a really good example. Ulrika, you have a comment on that?
Yeah, I think, I mean, the honesty women are living in a way, and also the fact that women admit mistakes, that is something which is not, it's really not in the male's world, so to say. So that is always a fact. When I admitted a mistake in being a president of a university, they said, oh, we knew that she can't do it, just because I admitted a mistake. And men are doing so many mistakes, and they never admit them. So I think that's a very difficult and a very different behavior of men and women.
Absolutely. That was exactly with Jacinda Ardern as well. You know, she's too weak. She admitted she had mental health issues. It shows that women just aren't cut out for higher level politics and to run a country. But, you know, when we look back at COVID, one of the best responses to the pandemic were the women-led countries like New Zealand and Iceland and others as well, which was very, very interesting. So I wanted to switch to talk a little bit about public funding. And so what happens to the public funding that might have been supporting a female scientist when she leaves her career? Does it depend on her stage of career? I mean, it seems to me that if public funding has been used to support a female scientist, and then because of these very difficult conditions that she's working under, she has to leave, you know, that seems like a tremendous, you know, inefficient use of resources.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we have multiple examples of that. I mean, we just had a case in Switzerland of in the medical field, you know, where we have more than half women students at the beginning of a medical field. And then we have this tradition of this assistant time where people are expected to work 80 hours, you know, which I call the filter to get rid of the women, because, you know, this is also the time where they would consider having a family. I mean, I had also two kids, but you cannot work 80 hours a week. This is impossible with two kids, small kids in the process of those years. And that's a very clear filter. And people argued that you need to do that to be a qualified doctor. Yeah. Who argued and who said this was really good? I personally want to have a doctor who is actually had enough sleep before they actually work on me. So these are kind of just simple examples where, you know, we're wasting the education of all these people by artificial filters, whatever the filters are, defined by a male world, which is actually not justified. And then we lose them again. We lose them out of paying taxes. We lose them out of paying into the social security programs everywhere. It is a huge amount of loss for us all.
So, Janet, do you have some thoughts?
Yeah, and if you look at the science funding specifically, this is, of course, there are going to be some differences in the United States and in Europe. In Europe, there tends to be more base funding that goes along with positions. But to the extent that public investments are made in specific scientific projects, it's usually with the expectation that those will move forward over time and not be cut off in an untimely fashion. And that's, you know, that can happen when a woman leaves the position, that the projects that she was engaged with, the ideas that she's driving, just sort of dissipate. In the European system, where there's a lot of public investment in the position itself, some of those resources fall back to the colleagues. So there can be actually an advantage to colleagues if somebody has built up a big lab and walks away from it, all the instruments are still there. Other people can take them over.
So in some ways, you could almost say there's an incentive for men to kind of drive their, if you really want to look at it harshly, drive their female colleagues out because there is perhaps a direct economic benefit to them. Eureka?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it's one point, as Janet just said, but then also it's a loss of expertise and it's a loss of this particular perspective, which is clearly different from the perspective of men. And I mean, coming together, those two perspectives of men and women making the success. And so it's really not only a loss of money and a drive of the money to the male academia, but it's also a loss of expertise and a loss of perspective. And that's really, really sad.
So Janet, do you have some additional thoughts on that?
Yeah, I'd also like to point out the cost to society.
Right.
So one thing that has been publicized quite a bit is that women are more likely to die of heart disease than men. And partly that's because the interventions are not recognizing that a woman is actually having a heart attack and are not appropriate because a lot of the research, almost all the research, was done on men. And I think that if you have women involved in the system, they will see those little inadequacies, shall we say, in the patient pool.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I know in the United States, for example, it wasn't, I think, until 1992 or 1993 that women of a childbearing age were even allowed to participate in clinical trials. And all the animal models and all the clinical trials were done involving men. And as you said, there are certain conditions, cardiovascular disease is one of them that presents very differently. I think diabetes, asthma are two examples of other conditions that do as well. And also, doctors aren't trained to look at how symptoms present differently in women than in men. So they're going to miss a lot of those symptoms. So to your point, Janet, you know, if your doctor is a male doctor, he hasn't been trained what to look for with respect to the different ways that cardiovascular disease presents in women, he's going to miss that entirely. And that could, you know, have some life devastating consequences.
And even in animal models, mostly male animals are used.
Exactly. And I know a lot of companies now are calling for more diversity in clinical trials. I mean, there, you know, not only is there issues with women, but we saw in COVID, the Hispanic and the Black populations really suffered tremendously with the pandemic and also had some different responses to different types of treatment. Study after study has shown that diverse teams are more creative and more profitable. And we've been talking about some of the economic losses when a woman leaves her academic career. But let's just talk about overall losses in addition to economics. You know, we have, again, loss of knowledge, loss of solutions to problems. What are some of the things that the three of you have seen?
I mean, yeah, I've seen a loss of smart heads on one side, and on the other side, it's a loss of role models. That means that young female women, as a scientist, they are not motivated because they see that those ladies drop out. And I think it's so important. In my career, I did not have any female professor. So no
role
model.
Not a single one.
And now, I mean, they are role models, but they see them being kicked out. So that is very bad also for the next generations. And then when I'm talking to young scientists, then I see that very often they say, oh, yeah, but I mean, it seems to be difficult and so on. So it's also frightening them off.
So you're seeing fewer women going into science because they see these what the road ahead looks like, and that it's, instead of getting easier the longer their career goes on, it's actually getting harder. So I don't want to go that route, or I might get my education and get out and go into a different field. They may go work at a startup or an industry, or they may go into tech transfer, or they might go into IP law, but something else. They don't want to stay in academia.
Yes.
Ursula, you have some thoughts?
Yeah. I mean, another thing that I think the younger women see if the senior women disappear again through whatever mechanism is that they have the feeling they need to look away when they see a problem. So to survive, they need to accept a certain amount of discrimination. Actually, we even have coaches who tell the young people, look, if you're gonna, it's true, this is all not acceptable, but if you bring this issue forward, it's gonna be the end of your career. And that's being told today to young women, and they even see it with the senior women who have the courage to stand up and say, something is wrong here. We need to change something based on all the experience that we have. And we have three women here, very successful in their career, who tell you it's not good right now. But the resistance is enormous, and we need to break this.
Yeah. Janet, you have some thoughts as well.
Yeah, I'd like to say, too, that this is not just about women and men. And in several regards, one is that there are quite a few young men who are also unhappy with the system as it is and are sometimes subjected to the same kinds of hostility, some unearned authorship, all these different power problems that can happen. These also happen to young men. And many of them also drop out and feel really discouraged by all of this. At the same time, men who understand that there are problems with the system are important allies for us, and to continue to speak as though it was all women against all men, I think is doing a disservice to both sides, and especially a disservice to men who see the problems and are willing to stand up and try and help change things.
Yeah, let's talk about that for a second, allyship, because it is so important. Tell us who some of the allies that you're seeing. It's obviously younger generation type scientists, but talk a little bit more about what you've seen and the importance.
So I mean, actually say that's not really true. It's not only or even sometimes mainly the younger scientists. Sometimes you get scientists who are toward the end of their career, male scientists or even in retirement, and they are willing to step up. I mean, at a certain point, they don't have that much to lose anymore. And I think that can be very important when it happens. There are also some senior politicians, for example, in Germany, who are very vocal on some of these issues that are problematic in the academic system. Sometimes the young men can also be sympathetic because they might be interested, for example, in spending more time with their families. Then you sort of have this middle range where the competition starts to get very intense, and perhaps they can be the hardest to deal with.
And in addition, the leadership makes a huge difference. You know, they set the example. I mean, the MIT 1999 MIT report was totally supported by the leadership, by the dean and the president. And that made the success, right? So I really think if there is a leadership that suppresses, you know, the voices, the critical voices of the successful senior women, then there is something wrong with the governance.
Yeah, MIT in that report. And then there was subsequently a book that came out last year about that as well. You know, I do give MIT a lot of kudos for having the courage to stand up and admit they were wrong, that they, you know, the way women scientists were treated there, they made some big mistakes and they're trying to rectify them. Eureka, I think you have some comments as well.
Yes, I think that is very, very true. And I read the book. But I think what is also important to realize that some women who come on the top, I mean, to be president of a university, they don't dare to support those women, I mean, do what we just said or what Ursula just said. And so they are scared, because if you as a female president really start supporting those women and do the right things in what we discuss now, then you are easily to be not reelected, or to there are reasons which they find to get you out of this position. And that happened a couple of times just in this year in Germany. So I think it is something which we really have to talk about, to change the government. It's not only for, I mean, in terms of women, but I mean, the government system in German universities has to be changed, and it has to be more transparent, and the procedures and decisions have to be more clear. And then they need to implement professional governing and supervisory boards, so that not the lady on top, so to say, is fired because she's trying to do exactly what we are asking for. That's something very important, and we have to stop the abuse of power. That's the main point.
And I think that's a great segue into my next question, which is change. And Ursula, you mentioned change as well. You know, let's start with higher education and research institutions. What does they need to do to address some of these systemic problems? I mean, Ursula, you mentioned you had a lot of thoughts on what needed to be changed. So let's start there, and then we'll move into governments. What do you think that HERIs need to do to change?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think that the governance is insufficient in many aspects, especially in the German-speaking universities. And I've seen it now for more than 30 years. You know, initially every professor was acting alone, reporting to the president, and then the university grows, it becomes unmanageable, and then the leadership was delegated into the so-called autonomous departments, with no prior trainings, with no common standards of how to govern, how to give access, how to inform people about the resources. I mean, these departments in the German and Swiss universities are distributing money, you know, no concept of conflict of interests. I mean, no wonder we have a problem, if you ask anybody. So there are simple, basic governmental principle of accountability and transparency, rotation into leadership position. And on top of it, you know, when you look at the job of a professor, of a successful professor, you know, it's a huge job. And we're just getting more and more and more responsibility. And if you as a department head has to deal with a problem, I mean, this problem can take 90% of your time. And so we need a more professional way of dealing with these issues. I mean, we're a more diverse group of people, and therefore problems are normal. You have to deal with it, but we need a more professional way how to deal with it.
Janet, do you have some thoughts?
Yeah, I'd like to come back to one word that Orsi mentioned there, and that's transparency. I think that transparency can go a long, long way to really opening up the door for discussion. By itself, it's not the solution, but it allows you to understand what are the facts, what are the resources, how are the resources distributed. And this is something that, especially in publicly funded institutions, I think is simply a right of the taxpayer, that these institutions would be transparent about their resources and their processes. And, you know, there's the old saying that sunshine is the best disinfectant. But I think this would make a huge difference to open this up, and also to be clear about the gender distribution in all of these allocations and advancement and other things like that.
Exactly. I mean, I totally agree with Janet on that one. And with transparency comes accountability, because people then ask question, why is this person getting that much? And you cannot give everybody the same amount. It has to be a performance. But my experience is actually that my colleagues did not want to define a performance criteria. Actually, one person even told me, I recognize excellence when I see it. So he has this autonomy that he doesn't have to follow any accountability on his judgment, why he considers now this person to be excellent or not.
He just knows it when he sees it.
Yeah. And it's actually, I mean, I agree, it's not totally trivial to define this performance criteria. And it's also a dynamical process which needs to be revisited, and it's different for each field. But if we're not making that step, on what are we judging people? And that's people shy away from transparency because they don't want to have this discussion, right?
Absolutely. Ulrika, you have some comments?
Yeah, I have a slightly different point to this discussion in the moment, because I think it's also important that the freedom of research and teaching, which is very important, does not mean that professors can do what they want. And let me give you one example from in terms of abuse of power. I have seen in my presidency of a German university two cases of severe sexual harassment. And after having a clear proof, I immediately dismissed both professors and introduced a disciplinary inquiry. Then I was talking to other university heads in Germany, and it was clear that all of them have seen those cases, but to my knowledge, none of them had ever initiated a
disciplinary. They let them stay.
They let them stay, or they let them go to another university. One of the two, he came from another university where he did the same thing. And moreover, in the court in both cases only reacted after 5 years. So, I mean, it was from my disciplinary up to the court case, 5 years. And the judgment was in the first court hearing below the degree of the penalty that forbids the person to be a professor. So that is unbelievable in a way. It means that the opposition position now takes another year, and the victims have to live again through all the doings. It's unbelievable for me in a way that the system works like that. And it's showing the inability of the system. And it is also explaining why so many women do not dare to accuse the offenders. And that was an experience which was really showing what is the abuse of power and how unable the system is to handle those cases. I just wanted to give that as an example. And it's real, and it's ongoing today. I mean, it's unbelievable.
And what about governments? I mean, we've alluded to that a little bit here. I mean, these systemic issues, you know, not only are faced in universities, you mentioned them in corporations. They exist. I mean, I'm a patent attorney. I've seen them in law firms. They exist all over. So what do our governments need to do?
I think the difference between universities and companies at the end want to make money, right? There is a reality check. And you know, if a person is really super successful and a money-making person, I mean, people will not want to lose that person because of sexual harassment and all that kind of stuff, you know. At a university, there is no reality, you know. Sometimes, I mean, especially not at the European universities where they don't really care how much third-party money somebody brings. Has no implication. At ETH, has no implication for you. You just become a problem. You need more space. You need more support from the administration. There is no positive feedback if you bring in more funding, except that you are more successful in your research because you can run it better. So there is the governance, you know, in terms of the governance needs to recognize performance, but performance needs to be sensibly defined, and it needs to be accountable for all, and it needs to be open, and it needs to be transparent. I think, you know, if we would achieve this 101 level of good governance, we would already make a huge progress from where we are today. And, you know, with the women, when they're in school, they're doing just fine with very clear rules.
Janet, do you have some thoughts on this?
Yeah, so I think Ursula is absolutely right, but her focus is a little bit, okay, what are the institutions doing? And there's also pressures on the institutions from outside. And there are two very strong pressures. One comes from funding agencies. And this has already been put into place to some extent in the United States, where the National Science Foundation is demanding a certain accountability on the part of people who would be getting money for external funds from them. In Europe, where the government is providing the funds to many of the universities, it's the federal or state governments that can demand accountability. And they can say, well, you get this much money from us. We have some expectations for you too.
Right.
Yeah, I think that was very important, as Jeanette now said, because yeah, the universities are state organizations, and the government has to actively execute its supervision function for the research organization. And it has to guarantee orderly processes. They have to introduce official policies and take care for the proper compliance. And compliance is another, I think we didn't say it yet, but it's another important point that
I fully agree.
That we need that. And I mean, again, I mean, freedom of research is fine. But I mean, compliance is important if we talk about just the social system of a university. And it's very, very important.
As the podcast comes to a close, I wanted to ask the three of you, what messages would you like to leave with your colleagues? And maybe, Jeanette, I'll start with you.
Okay, thank you. So there are a couple of main messages. One is to the women, and that is always to think about acting collectively. When individuals try to go out there and campaign, it's just not a winning strategy. You can win by getting grouped together with collective concerns for collective action. And also to look at the allies. As I said, there are some men out there who really feel the same way. We need to bring them on board. We need to include them in that collective. And for the men, I would say, whether or not they feel that there are really these issues for women, look at their own students. Look at how much they benefit from their female doctoral students. Think about what's going to happen to those women later in their career. Are they going to continue to be the network that the male professors need? There'd be a lot of advantages to men also to make sure that it's a more fair situation for women.
I fully agree with this. I mean, this is also why we started at ETH, for example, the Women Professor Forum, you know, where Jeanette and I have been president with. But the other thing that the women need to be aware of, that these informal power groups are there, okay? And there is resistance, and there is a tendency that women are played against women. And this is something which is really bad, and a lot of lies are being told about what one woman said about another woman, just to put in a division, divide and conquer. I mean, it's an old way, and the women need to be aware that they are played against each other. I mean, there's a lot of reputation that women, you know, Stutenfight and all these kind of names that this is cultivated stories, you know, to drive us women away. We need to be more flexible. We have some core values that we defend, and there we stand close together, and the better governance is better for us all. And just, you know, being then pulled out for some special benefits of being part then of it, this is not helping the cause. And my message to my male colleague is very clear. I think there is much less BS work. You know, we can actually do more good science if we actually work for better governance. Better governance does not mean more bureaucracy, not more overhead of unused, you know, of a lot of bureaucratic things, which is always used as a message that better governance is not what we should focus on.
And Ursula, I completely agree with you. You know, our former Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, had a great quote on that about women against women. She said, there's a special place in hell for women who don't help other women. And I echo that. We need to start fighting one another and work to build one another up. Eureka, go ahead.
Yeah, you asked us what we would recommend to our male colleagues. And I think that we have to tell them, come out of the old boys club and be open for modern government with flat hierarchies, team spirit, transparency, and open communication. and also make constructive use of the input of women and their female perspective, since success is increased by diverse opinions.
Absolutely.
Can only be good to work together.
And dual careers are a chance, not a problem, you know, because it gives you more variation in changes in your careers, which, you know, you can take a more risky career step. If you have a dual career situation, you know, I think it's an enrichment. And actually, as my husband and I, we raised our two kids totally equally. And so our kids have both a father and a mother, and the father had as close relationship to the kids as I did. So it's only something that adds value to your own life.
Absolutely. And think how much we could achieve if all genders, all underrepresented groups, if we all use our collective knowledge, our education, our experiences to help, you know, battle some of the really pressing challenges we have right now, whether it's climate change, it's, you know, pandemics, things like that. I mean, you know, we saw what we could as a collective group do with COVID in just a short period of time. But think of some of these bigger challenges that we face if we all just work together instead of putting one another down, what we would be capable of.
Indeed. Exactly.
Well, thank you so much, Eureka, Ursula, and Janet, for being a part of the podcast today. It's been really great to have you here.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you.
That brings us to the end of this insightful episode. We've discussed a critical need for reforms to address gender-based attrition and create environments where all individuals, regardless of gender, can thrive and contribute meaningfully to scientific endeavors. It's clear that by championing diversity and equity, we are not only enhancing the quality and efficiency of academia, but also fostering a more just and innovative society. Thank you to Janet, Eureka, and Ursula for joining us and sharing these important insights. Be sure to tune in next time as we continue to explore pressing issues shaping tech transfer and our world. Until then, stay curious and keep the conversation going.
Thanks for listening to Autumn on the Air with Lisa Mueller. Get social with us and share your thoughts. You can tweet us at AUTM or visit us online at AUTM.net. We'll be back next week on the air. Be sure to join us.